from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just 48 hours before his departure as governor of Illinois today, George Ryan commuted the death sentences of all 167 death row inmates in his state. The death penalty, he said in a dramatic announcement on Saturday, is fundamentally flawed and unfair. His decision has renewed public debate across the country on capital punishment. Tonight on Point, the future of the death penalty in America. We begin with Ray Long, State House reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who has been covering Governor Ryan's decision. I asked him what the reaction has been in Illinois to the governor's blanket clemency for death row inmates.
Well, it's a mixed bag. There are really people out there who are genuinely enthusiastic about his decision, and there are really people out there who are angry at the governor for making this decision. The people who are enthusiastic think it's a great decision because the Illinois death row system, the Illinois death row law, has been flawed for years and years, and there is a belief that something had to be done, and something had to be fixed, and then George Ryan decided he wanted to fix it. However, the people who are enraged about this decision are families whose relatives have died at the hands of some of the people on death row. Also, there are prosecutors up and down the state who believe that the governor should have just stayed out of this.
Governor Ryan said he had never intended to be an activist on this issue, but he sure has become one. Describe to us how this became so central to this man's tenure in office.
It really goes back to 1977 when he voted to reinstate the death penalty in Illinois. Then when he was in the governor's office beginning in 1999, in January 99, and a little more than 2 months into that term, the governor had to face an execution. And when it came time for him to actually do it, he vacillated for a long time. He was trying to figure out whether he should go through with it. He was really concerned because only weeks before there had been an inmate who was on death row, and he had come within 48 hours of execution, but he was later freed when somebody else confessed to a double killing that he was in prison for.
So George Ryan was afraid he would be possibly throwing the switch on an innocent man. What seems to be at the heart of the governor's motivation here? Is it concern about procedural problems which might lead to the execution of an innocent person, or has he had a conversion in himself to philosophically, morally oppose the death penalty?
Well, nobody can really get into the governor's head on this. He has spoken about how he has seen the system. He's seen flaws in the system. He's seen high numbers of appeals overturned. And he can't understand how this could happen when the ultimate penalty in these cases is obviously death. There's no room for mistakes, and that's the position he had said, and that's the position that he has been pushing and has evolved really into a person who really seems to think that if we can't get it right, don't do the death penalty.
These commutations came in the very last hours or days, in any case, of the governor's term. The inauguration of a new governor takes place today. Was this step a surprise?
He seemed to be moving closer and closer to that, although he even said in his speech that he had ruled out at one time a blanket commutation to emptying out death row. But then he came back and forth, and he finally decided to go with it, and it seemed like he was moving toward that in the closing days of his term.
Can the governor's decision be reversed? Is that likely? Is there any conversation about that, or are people accepting this is the way it is? They're off death row.
There is indeed a conversation about trying to do that, but in the Illinois Constitution, the powers are quite broad, and in fact, there is not a whole lot of hope out there for a lot of people who are doing it, but there are prosecutors and individuals in state government who are really scouring the law books to determine whether there's any way to do anything.
How have prosecutors responded today?
Prosecutors have been upset in very vitriolic fashion. They have said that this is hurting the victims' families once again, that the governor should have let the courts play out the case, or cases rather, and In fact, there has been a lot of anger in the ranks of prosecutors throughout the state.
Ray Long, put the governor's decision in the context of his term as governor. He's a one-term governor. He's not running for re-election. How has this sat in the broader context of his time in the state house?
Well, this governor has been consumed with a scandal that started out with licenses being sold for bribes in the Secretary of State's office while he was Secretary of State.
This is driver's licenses.
This is driver's licenses, correct. And over the years, there has been a gradual move closer to him. He has watched many of his friends, many of his inner circle, be indicted or accused of felonies involved in the cover-up, and even his Inspector General in the Secretary of State's office, a longtime friend of his, has pleaded guilty in the case. So the death penalty issue has been a counterbalance to really this all-consuming scandal that has affected his career.
So does it look as though he's been reaching for a kind of moral triumph to offset the tar of scandal, or are people accepting this as his view of the death penalty now as more genuine than that?
That will be debated for years and years and years to come. There's little doubt about that. And he says that he's sincere about this. He gives comments that would back that up. He walks us through how he has evolved on the issue. But then there is still, with this constant drumbeat of scandal going on right now, in fact, his former chief of staff and former campaign manager is on trial right now in Chicago in the scandal.
And finally, Ray Long, what do we know about Governor George Ryan's successor coming into power in Illinois? What's his view of the death penalty?
Rod Blagojevich, the incoming Democratic governor, has criticized the governor for Governor Ryan, the outgoing governor, for taking this blanket approach toward the death penalty. And Governor Blagojevich and his staff have indicated that they will be searching to see if there's anything that can be done about this. But again, very few people, including legal scholars, think that the powers of the governor in Illinois can be overturned. The pardoning, the clemency powers of the governor can be overturned.
But in the meantime, tonight, scores and scores of inmates from death row are no longer under the sword.
That's correct. That's correct. It's a major change in Illinois.
Ray Long, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ray Long is statehouse reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He spoke with us earlier from Springfield, Illinois. He wasn't the first governor to commute death sentences, but outgoing Illinois Governor George Ryan's emptying of his state's death row is the most dramatic anti-death penalty statement by a major public figure in decades. Not only did Ryan commute the sentences of more prisoners at one time than any other governor, 167 people responsible for 250 deaths, but following a period in which states have been executing fewer death row inmates than in decades past, the governor's move has sparked a new national conversation on death penalty reform and the morality of the ultimate punishment. When DNA testing and retrials are exposing flaws in sentencing and conviction, is it time to reconsider the death penalty? What do you think of Governor Ryan's dramatic decision? Does it lead you to reconsider the death penalty? Is capital punishment right? Is it a deterrent or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Bruce Shapiro, co-author with Reverend Jesse Jackson and Representative Jesse Jackson, Jr. of Legal Lynching, The Death Penalty in America's Future. Mr. Shapiro is also a contributing editor at The Nation magazine. Good evening and welcome, Bruce Shapiro.
Very glad to be here.
Very glad to have you. And joining us tonight from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is John Adams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. Good evening and welcome, John Adams.
Mac Adams, and yes, good to be here.
Mac Adams, my mistake, and thank you for correcting me. Bruce Shapiro, let me turn to you first. Tell us what you know about Governor George Ryan's long and remarkable journey that led him to this very dramatic decision over the past weekend.
Well, I've spoken with Governor Ryan in some depth about this and certainly followed it very closely. You know, your guest earlier, the Chicago Tribune reporter Ray Long, accurately described it. I think that what's important about Governor Ryan's journey is that it's actually typical of where many Americans find themselves. If you look at the polls, if you look at where the state of public opinion seems to be.
Governor what do you mean by that?
Well, Governor Ryan was a man who was a conservative Republican from Southern Illinois. He was pro-death penalty. As a state legislator, he had voted to put the death penalty on the books in Illinois. And he went into office as governor, a strong proponent. When confronted with the facts, however, of how the death penalty was applied in Illinois, and in particular with a parade of innocence cases, more than a dozen people who were released from death row in Illinois who were exonerated factually when it turned out that their confessions had been coerced under torture, or when it turned out that the one case, Andrew Porter, a retarded inmate who had been convicted of something that someone else ultimately confessed.
And was just hours from being executed when that was discovered.
I mean, what's interesting, in the Andrew Porter case, I think more than any other shocked Governor Ryan. Porter was a man of an IQ of 058 or so who had been convicted of killing two people in Illinois, in Chicago. And his case was stopped. His execution was stopped 2 days beforehand, not because of any questions about innocence, but because the question was, well, should a mentally retarded person be executed? Now, the Supreme Court last year actually took this issue in a different case and decided no, but at that time, retarded people could be executed, and a federal judge stopped the execution. And with the time that was bought by that stay, some students from Northwestern University began to do the work that the Chicago police should have done in the first place, investigated, talked to witnesses, in fact, found the man who actually did it, and Porter was freed.
And then the Chicago Tribune jumped in. The whole thing began to unravel. They found lots and lots of cases that had been mishandled, and pretty soon the governor is looking at some switches he doesn't want to pull. Still, this is an extraordinary number of commutations in one blanket commutation. Do you think, Bruce Shapiro, that given the state of the national conversation, which has been very high in Illinois but not necessarily so high elsewhere, is this one rock in the pond, or is this part of a wave that's going to actually push back against the death penalty?
Well, I think both. I think, first of all, this is a watershed moment, you know, in terms of the number of people freed, or not freed, but
taken off death row.
Taken off of death row. There's never been anything like this. But I also think that if you look around the country, doubt about capital punishment is popping up in all kinds of unexpected places. 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, a outspoken conservative and proponent of capital punishment, gave a speech before judges in Minnesota saying, "You people are lucky you don't have capital punishment. These cases are tearing our judiciary apart, and the false conviction cases we're seeing are undermining credibility in the process."
John McAdams, let me turn to you. The governor said on Saturday this is a flawed system and it's fundamentally wrong, yet we've heard for many, many years, for practically all time, that this is a deterrent, and it's right, and it's just. Where do you stand?
I think it probably is a deterrent. The evidence on that isn't entirely clear. What is clear is that claims by opponents of the death penalty that it's not a deterrent are fundamentally bogus. They're usually based on very poor use of statistics. Interestingly, there have been three quite recent studies out, all done by economists, one out of Emory University, one out of the University of Houston, and one out of the University of Colorado, all showing a significant deterrent effect of the death penalty. And this will eventually affect the debate when finally, you know, people, politicians, office holders, actually begin to pay attention to this. Interestingly, contrary to what your guest says, the death penalty is, in terms of public support, doing quite fine now. Over the past couple of years, public opinion has moved back in favor of the death penalty. It had declined in the 1990s. In the Gallup poll, there's been, in the last 2 years, a six-point increase.
Looks like it may be back. Stand by, John McAdam. We have to take a short break. Excuse me, but we're talking about the future of the death penalty tonight as Illinois' outgoing governor commutes 167 death sentences. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the future of the death penalty in America as Illinois' outgoing governor commutes 167 death sentences in one stroke, 163 men, 4 women, a blanket commutation by outgoing Governor George Ryan. What do you think of Governor Ryan's decision to clear death row? Does it cause you to reconsider your own stance on the death penalty? Governor Ryan says America's embrace of the death penalty makes us partners in death with third world tyrants. Do you agree? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, John McAdams, Associate Professor of Political Science. And joining us tonight from New Haven, Connecticut, Bruce Shapiro, a contributing editor at The Nation and co-author of Legal Lynching, The Death Penalty and America's Future. John McAdams, I had to interrupt you there, but you were saying that you have found actually support for the death penalty is quite strong across the United States.
Well, in the last 2 years in the Gallup poll, it's increased from 66% to 72%. Ryan's Democrat successor and the governorship of Illinois has criticized Ryan very sharply. The new governor of Maryland is promised to end the moratorium there. I mean, I think we all know about the events that have happened. Tim McVeigh was executed. 80% plus of Americans said he deserved execution. We had the 9/11 terrorist attacks. We had the Beltway sniper, which now becomes Beltway snipers, plural. And all of these things have had the tendency of convincing Americans that the death penalty is necessary in some cases.
And yet, on the other side, John McAdams, we've had DNA testing come in, and DNA testing reveal that some men and perhaps women, I'm not sure, sentenced to death were incorrectly convicted of their crime. And we've had these unbelievable stories in Illinois. The governor went through the laundry list. He said 33 of the death row inmates that he had power over had represented at trial by an attorney later disbarred. More than 35 African-American defendants convicted, he says, not by a jury of their peers, but by all white juries. More than two-thirds of the inmates on death row African-American. 46 inmates convicted on the basis of testimony from jailhouse informants. This governor, this man, looks at those numbers and says, this system is a mess. I can't risk putting innocent people to death.
But begin, remember, the media are now beginning to debunk some of these inflated claims of innocence. USA Today actually ran a front-page story last Tuesday. The claim, for example, from the Death Penalty Information Center that there are 102 people that have been proved innocent, proved factually innocent, who've been on death row and gotten off. There have been 102 people who've gotten off. Only on my minority of those really are known to be innocent, and I forget the exact numbers, 10 or 12 were actually decisively exculpated on the basis of DNA evidence. For the vast majority of the rest, it's basically quibbling over the evidence. They got off in some way or another, often for procedural reasons, but there's room to quibble over the evidence, but for the most part, a majority of them were probably guilty.
So you're right across the border there from Illinois. You've surely watched this as a professor of political science, Governor Ryan's journey. What's happening here? Is this some kind of dramatic Paul on the road to Damascus, just falling down on the road and seeing the light, or is it something more calculating in your view?
You're asking me to talk about his psychology, which is very difficult to do. I think some people do turn into sort of self-righteous moralists on this, where their moralism would be better used with concern for the victims. They decide they're going to try to protect the convicted murderers on death row. But you're asking me to talk about his psychology, which I don't know much about, frankly. I'm not sure anyone does, and except his wife, who is very mad at him for doing this.
Well, it's been on a very public stage for several years. Well, it may be and it may not be. He certainly, as one individual, took a very dramatic step. Bruce Shapiro, please respond to John McAdams' characterization of American attitudes towards death penalty and the trend line that we see.
Well, I think, I'm not going to go through each and everything he's saying here. I think the fact is that there are a large number of deeply disturbing and shocking innocence cases. And I agree only a minority of them are from DNA. In fact, most of them involve something no more complicated than law students or college students or paralegals doing work that police officers or prosecutors should have done in the first place. The fact is that whether you're talking about 102 cases or 80 cases or 72 cases, there's an awful lot of people who've come awfully close to being killed who the law says shouldn't have been there. That's very disturbing to a lot of people. The trend line, if you want to look at it in the long view, goes from a solid 70% or more, 68% supporting capital punishment 5 years, 10 years ago, to now when, while there's a little variation from year to year, if given a choice of life in prison without parole, a majority of Americans, or 48%, 49%, nearly half of all Americans, in any poll you choose to look at, will say, no, we would take life without parole in lieu of capital punishment. That's one way of measuring opinion. Another way of measuring opinion is to look at the number of judges around the country, state judges and federal judges, who are asking questions about capital punishment. We've had judges in New York and elsewhere, federal judges, who say the federal death penalty may be unconstitutional, and that's now being battled out. Judge Rakoff in New York, the federal judge who raised this constitutionality issue, said that in fact all of this, the cascade of false conviction cases amounts to information that the Supreme Court didn't have the last time it looked at the legality of capital punishment. So judges are raising these questions. Scholars are raising these questions. And I think the reality is that unless you're really dug into a trench on this issue, anyone with an ethical sensibility has to be alarmed by the idea of individuals, someone like Andrew Porter, coming within 48 hours of execution for a crime he didn't commit and being freed only by an accident of history. That's deeply disturbing. And I think that many Americans, and the polls show the bulk of people, are rethinking, are engaged in a process of rethinking, which I think Governor Ryan actually exemplifies. And that's one reason that I think this gesture of his resonates.
A huge gesture. Bruce Shapiro, John McAdams, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Edwin Colfax. He joins us from Chicago. He's director of the Death Penalty Education Project at Northwestern University. Good evening and welcome, Edwin Colfax.
Good evening. Good to be with you.
Good to have you, and thanks for joining us. You've had a front row seat, and more than that, at Northwestern. You've been very instrumental in digging up some of the key findings that led to Governor Ryan's conversion. We heard earlier that some of those findings have been thrown into doubt more recently. Is that true?
I don't think so. I think the cases here in Illinois that of exonerated, the people being exonerated from death row, are all standing very solidly. I don't think there's any question that any of these cases are, you know, there are no open questions that are legitimate. Bruce Shapiro mentioned Anthony Porter's case, and Porter's the role of the Porter case in Governor Ryan's thinking was tremendous. And it was journalism students here at Northwestern who, digging around, eventually found the perpetrator, and he confessed on videotape. It's a rock-solid exoneration. So, you know, having so many exonerations has really given the governor pause. What else could he do, he says.
But, Edwin Colfax, you're there in Illinois. You've seen the reaction over the weekend and today to the governor's decision. How are Illinoisans taking this? Are people split down the middle on it? Is there outrage at the same time that there's support? And how do people describe the foundation for their view?
Well, there's no question that the governor's decision has evoked a mixed reaction. But I think that the more that people learn about the governor's reasons for taking the step that he did, which are articulated very clearly in his speeches, the more they agree with him. I think, you know, the public has been on the same road that George Ryan has been on, through some great reporting by the Chicago Tribune that chronicled the flaws and the failures of the system, the arbitrariness and the outright inaccuracy. The public is becoming more and more educated about the magnitude of the problem, and I think the more they do, the more they recognize this to be the proper course.
Governor Ryan said in his speech on Saturday that out of 1,000 murders in Illinois last year, only 2% of that 1,000 were sentenced to death. He used that as evidence that the death penalty is not a deterrent.
And it's also a part of the case for how the death penalty is arbitrary. I think many people assume that small fraction of murders that get singled out for the death penalty somehow are the worst of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no question that any murder is a horrible thing, but the reality is that it's the luck of the draw in large part.
What do you mean by that? How?
Well, each state's attorney here in Illinois, and there are 102 of them, one in each county, essentially makes the determination about when to pursue a death penalty case. They have enormous latitude, and there are no statewide standards. There is no statewide oversight of that decision-making process. The result is that if you commit a murder in downstate Illinois, you're five times more likely to be given a death sentence than you do than if you're here in Cook County in Chicago. Now, that kind of disparity of sentencing practices simply is inconsistent with our commitment to equality before the law. We're talking about a very fundamental element of American democracy.
And yesterday or Saturday, the governor commuting 167 death sentences. Edwin Colfax, please stand by. A lot of people want to join our conversation. Let me invite them in. Jason's calling from Stafford, New Hampshire. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good job to you and your producers for getting this on so quickly. You know, I agree with what I'm hearing, basically, in that this is a question of questioning the system. It's not doubts about death penalty, the moral aspect of it. It's doubts about, are we able to convict people and feel assured that we're doing this correctly?
Jason, let me ask you, if you could feel confident in the conviction, would you prepared to stand morally by the death sentence?
I would, yes.
So for you, it's about the efficacy of the system. It's about the reliability of the system.
Exactly. That's exactly what I think this is about, and I think the governor has done a good job at stepping up and putting an exclamation point in front of this issue here, but I think he really does need to be very clear that that's what he's talking about and that's what he's concerned with, and see how we can move forward with correcting some of the flaws in the system to make sure that if we decide to take someone's life, we know that we're, you know, the system has just exhausted every ability to make sure they're doing a good job.
Be very, very sure. Jason, thanks for your call. Edwin Colfax, you've had a front row seat on this. Are the kinds of problems that have come up in convictions that led to death sentences the kinds of problems that could be remedied by people paying closer attention?
Well, there's no question that we could improve the system with a number of reforms, and the governor had appointed a blue ribbon panel, a special commission on capital punishment, that was full of experts that studied the issue for 2 years. What we got was a comprehensive report that was an indictment of the system and offered 85 recommendations that it said was necessary to make the system more fair and accurate. It acknowledged that even if we implemented every one of those, the system is administered by human beings, and we're always running the risk of mistake. So we could make improvements, but we can never, you know, we're human beings. We can't have a perfect system.
John McAdams, Governor Ryan said, our system is haunted by the demon of error, error in determining guilt, and error in determining who among the guilty deserves to die. Do you agree? Can it be remedied?
First of all, it can never be perfect because it is run by human beings. Ironically, the opponents of the death penalty want to impose on the death penalty a burden they would never put on any other penalty or indeed on anywhere else in public policy of operating perfectly. The death penalty process operates more fairly than any other penalty we've got. People have more opportunities for appeal. They're more likely to have good counsel. There's more public debate. There's more public attention. You know, how many people are not on death row but have been imprisoned for life or have been imprisoned for 30 or 40 years that are, in fact, innocent? And furthermore, we're not going to pay any attention to that. We don't much care about that because the death penalty is a hot-button issue. Opponents have fixated on the death penalty, and we don't seem to care very much if we lock somebody up for 30 or 40 years or even for life and they're innocent. So the question is, you know, how fair does it have to be? My answer is fairer than any other penalty that we have. And I have to point out that the people from Illinois continue to talk about one case because of the 13, there's really only one case where it's quite clear that the person was innocent. In a lot of other cases, what you've had is claims made by activists. I know, you know, if we were talking about the National Rifle Association giving us examples of how people have protected themselves with the firearms that they own, you folks, you know, journalists would naturally be a little wary of that, would not take it at face value. On the other hand, when these claims are made in regard to the death penalty, they too often have been taken at face value. They're getting to be debunked, but it's a slow process. Anything that journalists have repeated very, very frequently without questioning, it takes a while for people to understand that the numbers are vastly inflated.
Edwin Colfax, I've got to let you respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of cases where we've got solid DNA evidence that make the exonerations conclusive beyond the shadow of a doubt.
12 nationally.
The actual perpetrator, I mean, I could name particular cases. You know, the Ford Heights 4 case, Donald Jones was exonerated by DNA. The actual perpetrator in the wrongful conviction of Rolando Cruz and Alejandro Hernandez has been identified by DNA. So, you know, this, I mean, we could quibble about what counts as a real exoneration, but there's no question that there are a number of people.
Well, let's say 10 or 12 rather than 102. Let's be fair about what you've got.
Edwin Colfax, do you accept that number?
10 or 12? Absolutely not. I mean, it's scores.
That's the DNA numbers, 10 or 12. But there's some others that are doubtless innocent, many fewer than 102.
Edwin Colfax?
There's no question that a number of that the number of DNA exonerations hovers around 10 or 12. However, there are all sorts of other sorts of unreliable evidence that have been used in these prosecutions and have been debunked.
Mm-hmm.
To say, to just sort of throw out, well, they're probably guilty, when in fact the law of the land, the existing legal system, has determined that they don't belong in jail, that they were wrongfully imprisoned, is just outrageous. It's a smokescreen.
Bruce Shapiro, I want to bring you in here. Do you agree that this is the fairest track you can get on in America, the death sentence track?
I would invite anyone who thinks that capital trials in the United States are fair to go down to a courtroom in Houston where a fellow named George McFarland was on trial a few years ago, 1992, for a murder which he very possibly and probably didn't commit. He had a court-appointed lawyer who slept through the trial. Indeed, a reporter who was there recounted in gruesome detail the lawyer nodding off, snoring, starting, going back to sleep. And when he went to appeal the case and asked for some relief from the Texas courts, the Texas Court of Appeals said that the Constitution guarantees your right to a lawyer. It doesn't guarantee that the lawyer is awake. Now, we are talking here, and there is a difference with death cases. Hmm. However many procedural protections you put in, if indeed, as Professor McAdams says, this is a fallible system, at the end of the line, there's something which doesn't exist elsewhere in the criminal justice system.
And that's death, and we've got it. Bruce Shapiro, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Edwin Colfax, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know we have to let you go.
Thanks. Good to be with you tonight.
Edwin Colfax is director of the Death Penalty Education Project at Northwestern University. Is it time to reconsider the death penalty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the future of the death penalty in America as Illinois' outgoing governor commutes 167 death sentences, a blanket commutation by Governor George Ryan. What do you think? Is the death penalty a deterrent? Is it the only path to full justice in heinous crimes? Or is it a moral cancer? Is the Illinois governor a hero or a dreamer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tom's calling from Derry, New Hampshire. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have no moral problem with the death penalty. I'm speaking as I consider myself a fairly liberal Democrat.
All right.
When I say that. What I do have a problem with is two points, which have to some degree already been brought up. You were arguing in the last segment about what constitutes an acceptable number of innocent people to be on death row.
Yes.
I would argue that that number is zero. That's where I guess my liberalism comes in. If even one innocent person is put to death, then the death penalty is not acceptable to me.
But if you follow that through, Tom, is that an argument against the death penalty? As John McAdams points out, it's a fallible system.
Yes, it is.
Can I respond to that?
I would not currently vote for a death penalty. We do not have any way of determining universally in a blanket system across all the cases that would be appropriate for society to rid themselves of the cancer of these people who are, you know, the body kills cancer cells. Or is there some reason the society can't do that? I don't think there is.
But one innocent put to death by the state is too much for you? John McAdam, your response.
Well, is one person imprisoned for life who is innocent too many? Or a similar but somewhat different issue, is one innocent person killed, one innocent noncombatant killed in a just war, too many?
Tom?
One innocent person in jail has the opportunity to continue to try to clear their name. One innocent person in a grave does not.
But it does. But it often doesn't. It typically doesn't happen. It's also the case, AP ran a story fairly recently about people who had been imprisoned for 10, 15, 20 years and then let out. Mostly this was not capital cases. And what they found was that the damage was irreparable. That is to say, they were free and they were alive, but they didn't really have a life, as you and I would define a life, being an education, a family, a career, etc. Put somebody in jail for 20 or 30 years, you've taken a terribly large part of their life, and you can't give that back. And particularly if we don't seem to care that much whether they're innocent or not, if it's very unlikely that they will ever be vindicated. For example, we have movements to use DNA evidence for people facing capital trials, but nobody is saying very much about people, about DNA evidence for people, mandatory DNA testing for people who are facing over 20-year prison sentence.
Yeah, perhaps that will come into play eventually. Tom?
I think that the argument about whether a prison sentence takes away a large person part of a person's life is specious, because the idea that a person cannot regain their life, we can help them with that. Okay, if a person is pardoned after 20 years, we can't give them their life back. I'll agree, we can't give them the 20 years back that we took from them.
But even so, death is pretty singular. Death is still a pretty singular solution.
Right.
Tom, thank you for your call. Bruce Shapiro, in your book with Jesse Jackson, you describe the death penalty as legal lynching. That's pretty strong language.
Well, it's strong language. In part, it's historically based. In the late 19th century and through the early decades of this century, lynching, that is, execution that was legally tolerated in many states, if not legally sanctioned, was used to sort of enforce racial codes, and there's a bit of a historic link. But I think it's also true that if you look at some of these innocence cases, if you look at the kinds of poor representation that people face in capital cases have often gotten, if you look at the conditions under which people are convicted or in which false confessions have been coerced, lynching is not too strong a word, and it emphasizes the fact that death is at the end of this process, that as the Supreme Court has said, death is different. And by the way, I should say that I think that anyone who thinks that there are not large numbers of journalists, lawyers, law students, and everybody else out there trying to free innocent non-capital offenders is kind of an ignorant crackpot. I mean, the Innocence Project at Cardozo University, run by Barry Scheck of O.J. Simpson fame, is entirely devoted to non-capital DNA exoneration cases and has freed people of crimes ranging from rape to attempted murder to bank robbery.
So it happens, but we have read about the expense and difficulty of doing that on a very broad scale, at least at this point. Please stand by, Bruce and John McAdams. I want to welcome Joe. He's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. Like the previous caller from New Hampshire, I have a problem. Where is the number, Mr. McAdam, where is the number that's an acceptable number of dead people who are innocent of a crime? I have a really hard time assessing that on my behalf, and so I guess that the number for me would be zero as well.
Well, all right, then you answer the question I asked last time. What is the correct number of innocent people sentenced to life in prison? And this time, give me the number sentenced to life who never get out, because we know most of them don't get out. Some people, some people care a bit about non-capital convictions, but there's much, much less concern, way, way less, much less concern. And again, what is the right number of innocent people to be killed in a just war? You tell me that.
And I guess my response to that would be, you would hope that you would not need to. But first, let's consider two things here. One, the number of innocent people serving life in prison is different and distinctly different from the number of innocent victims, if you will. And I don't like that term because in a war, I'm not sure about innocence. But it's different from the dead people. The living and the dead are distinctly different in that there's no hope of, if you will, salvation for somebody who's dead, whether it was dead deliberately at the hands of the state or somebody who is dead not deliberately at the hands of the state. In both cases, the end result is the same. They're dead. And I guess this takes me back to what, as a conservative, leads me to the strange position of agreeing wholeheartedly with Mr. Shapiro, which is that if you look at the book The Law by Frederick Bastiat from mm-hmm. the 19th century, one of the things he set forth as a tenet of conservatism is that it is never appropriate for the state to do something that it is inappropriate for an individual citizen to do. Now, we do admit that there are cases when it is appropriate for an individual citizen to protect himself from a direct threat, and we do not view in the same light someone who kills another person in self-defense that we view the person who deliberately takes another life when he's not being threatened.
When individuals are not allowed to imprison people, are you saying the state should not be allowed to imprison people?
No, I'm saying that's the one power the state has. But having removed the threat, I'm not sure that I feel threatened by people serving a life sentence in prison, whereas if somebody is directly attacking me, if there is a direct threat against my person or that of my family, then I'm empowered to defend myself.
So there lies the distinction in the power of the state to imprison. Joe, thank you for your call. Let's get John in from Wheaton, Illinois. Hi, John. You're on the air. Hello, John. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I wanted to weigh in as an Illinoisan. I see this as a comment on the systematic inequalities that are present in the justice system in Illinois, more as a comment on the justice system in this particular area than as a pure stance on a higher moral issue.
John, the systematic inequalities weighted against whom?
I would say in a large part in the Chicagoland area, racial inequalities, but I would say that the system in northeastern Illinois is more politically motivated towards convenience and perhaps towards order than the pursuit of justice and being assured that you have the right suspect. And also I would say the very systematic use by law enforcement of unacceptable and very possibly unconstitutional means with their modes of interrogation, lack of videotaped interrogations, et cetera.
Right. John, we're running out of time, but we thank you for your Illinois voice tonight. Bruce Shapiro, there's a voice of concern about means, about prosecutors too concerned about convenience and not necessarily concerned about justice.
Well, I certainly think that we have seen in Illinois, but also in other states, the tendency of prosecutorial power to be abused. And this does not at all impugn the hardworking and honest and good prosecutors out there, but our whole Bill of Rights, our whole system of law, was set up to protect people from abuses of power. And as your caller from Illinois points out, what's been vividly on display in Illinois over the course of the last few years is a series of real prosecutorial abuses ranging from torture to packing juries to inadequate representation, all abuses of the criminal justice system, which call into doubt for a lot of people who thought they supported capital punishment in the past, the whole system of death. And that is really what Governor Ryan's grand gesture, this unprecedented in scale gesture of clearing Illinois death row is about. And the reason it's important nationally is that it feeds, I think, a growing sense of doubt that we can ever have an equitable, fair, workable death penalty in the United States.
And with that, we are out of time. Bruce Shapiro, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Bruce Shapiro is a contributing editor at The Nation and co-author with Reverend Jesse Jackson and Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. of Legal Lynching, the Death Penalty, and America's Future. And John McAdams at Marquette University, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, a California student takes a stand by sitting down. This is On Point. Lakeport, California, eighth grader Jim Woodbury is at the center of a civics lesson he'll remember for a lifetime. Jim refused to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance in his classroom. In this radio diary, Jim and his mom recall the battle with a social studies teacher that landed Jim on the school steps and his family on what they say is a path for justice.
On October 28th, when I didn't stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, the teacher told me that the next time I didn't stand, I'd be given a detention and sent to the office. And so that night I came home and my parents and I were talking and I decided that I just wasn't going to stand. It wasn't my belief. It was against my beliefs and I just felt like I should just stand up for my rights. And so the next day I called my mom from the office. She sent me to the office. And my parents encouraged me to stand. I did this totally on my own.
Jim told me some of the students were producing a morning program, and it began with the Pledge of Allegiance. And Jim came home, and he says, oh, they're doing the Pledge of Allegiance, but I'm sitting down. Like he always has. He says, you know, but I didn't stand up. And I said, oh, okay. And I didn't really think much about it because he never has before, and that's his choice. All along, I was hearing little things. Oh, he asked me to stand. He says I should stand, and but I haven't. And I didn't really know that anything was heating up. And it was really the teacher coming over and making a big deal about it that drew a lot of attention to what was going on.
Me not standing for the Pledge of Allegiance was never an issue in the past, just with this particular teacher. Well, the teacher gave me an attention, you know, and I went to the office, and they were trying to say, oh, you should stand out of respect. And so every day we eventually came to a thing where every day I'd just go outside when the Pledge of Allegiance was coming on, and then one day I decided I'd bring my teacher a packet of information about the laws and students' rights in classes, and so I decided I went online and I found some stuff from the ACLU, their website, and brought to him the next day, and he said, I don't care what the law is, get out of my class if you're not going to stand for the pledge, and folded it up and threw it in the trash.
When the teacher threw this information in the trash and told him to get out of the class, that was when I went and filed a complaint with the district superintendent, who after 30 days issued him a warning letter, which I just can't imagine meaning very much to somebody who would throw a kid's research in the trash and tell an entire class that he doesn't care what the law is. We went before the district board and asked them to reconsider our complaint and look into it further and see that maybe this teacher shouldn't be teaching in that school. He displayed fairly irrational and irresponsible behavior in declaring that he doesn't care what the law is and that he would destroy a student's work just seems frighteningly irrational.
After all this happened, I was taken out of school and put in independent study just because of the teacher's harassment, and we thought it would be better with all this going on if we did that. My parents' reaction to all this in general, I mean, they supported me in my, you know, whatever I want to do, they support me.
No, we're teaching him to survive in this world when we're not here to guide him.
Right now I'm taking two college classes at Mendocino College. I'm a little disappointed about leaving the school because, I mean, it would have been great if the teachers were nice to me and everything. And, you know, if they had been nice to me, it could have been a great experience.
Jim Woodbury and his mother, Victoria Kearney, live in Lakeport, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And this is WBUR.